Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
Actually suggested to remove horn from wild rhinos. Mm. And that seems like a... I was like, that's pretty genius, right? The problem with that concept is...
What can they teach us?
Right. And, I mean, ibuprofen does that, and better, okay, than rhino horn. So there's actually no scientific proof whatsoever that rhino horn has any therapeutic effect.
Many species are in crisis and need your help.
It's actually really sad. I mean, again...
I mean, could you imagine if our kids couldn't have the same experiences with rhinos that we've had?
I know. And,
or even one step further, our grandkids.
Yeah.
And then we have to tell them that it's our fault.
I know. It's...
Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
All right, so welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Angie.
Today, Angie, we get to talk about your favorite animal.
I'm very excited. We'll be talking about rhinos today.
I know, rhinos are awesome. They're amazing, and you and I both have been very fortunate to be able to work for these animals and do some research.
Sure, up right. close and personal, right. Absolutely. I've got to look at them, I've got to feed them,
pet
got to
them.
Study them, I've got to...
Scratch them.
Rub them yeah. All over their bodies, so yes, I'm a very, very intimate love for these beautifully horned creatures that are desperately in need of our actions to
right.
help save them.
Yeah, they're in big trouble, and they... What, the second largest land mammal?
Second largest yeah. land mammal,
next
absolutely.
To, next to my babies, the elephants. And I know in Florida, we've been very fortunate working with some conservation centers that we've been able to go and help with some of the research, which we'll cover a little bit today. You know, we don't want to bore people too much with the nerdy details, but, you know,
or
speaking...
cool details.
Yeah, or cool details. It is very awesome. Like, it's your research. Oh, it makes me so excited. And you know that, because for years we've been planning this. So I'm going to start with some more geeky science, Angie. I'm sorry. We're not going to bore you this time.
Oh, that's okay. You can wake me up when it's over, and we get to talk about fun stuff like behavior,
yeah,
nutrition.
And life cycles, stuff like that. But it's very, very important, I think, to kind of go over some of this geeky details to make people understand.
And there, I think there's some fun parts. As right. long as you talk about the woolly rhino, I will be listening.
Okay. So let's start out with amino acids. Yay.
Okay. I didn't see that one coming.
Not mitochondrial DNA. We're going amino acids. And the reason I bring this up is just they're organic compounds. Today in chemistry, today in science, we can break down everything. We know the chemical composition of pretty much anything terrestrial or, you know, anything on Earth we can get our hands on, right? I mean, you're doing analytical chemistry right now.
I am, and I wish I would have paid more attention in chemistry, my friend.
We're not going to be talking about analytical chemistry in this, but you're doing that right now with your research.
I am, yes. Yes, trying, struggling.
Yes, with your rhino stuff. But this, I think, will make sense in a second. So, let me just compare two substances, and then you try to guess what they are.
Okay.
So nitrogen, 15% of this compound is nitrogen. Both of them, about 15% nitrogen. Sulfur, okay, about 5% one, about 3% the other. Okay, not much difference. I mean, that's a little different, not much. Okay, then you go into some of the amino acids, the histidine, lysine, arginine. Hey, we've done some arginine research,
right? I don't want to eat this substance, yeah. whatever it is, because arginine is bitter.
Yeah, I know, it's gross. But hey, it's good stuff. 0.6, 2.5, 8.0, almost exactly the same. Okay, and then you can go down some of the other amino acids. I won't bore you with all of them. But do you know the difference between the two? There's not much, right?
No, they sound the same to me.
Yeah, so that's the difference between what's made up in the human hair, so our hair, and rhino horn. Absolutely no difference.
Interesting.
Right.
I always knew it was basically keratin-based.
Right.
But I didn't realize that it was, the profile was so similar to hair.
So like when you look, break it down chemically, there's no really minor differences. And if people really want rhino horn, I will add a little tryptophan, a little more sulfur for them so they can get this so-called medicinal effect that doesn't exist. They've done a lot of chemical analytical chemistry. Rhino horn does not differ from chimpanzee hair, our hair, goat hair, wool, cow horn, fingernails, porcupine quills. Like, they drop those like crazy. Let's go collect up a bunch of porcupine quills.
Right, and grind those up.
And grind those up and send them off to Asia. So, yeah, snake skin. Yeah, go ahead.
Yum.
Yeah. So there's no difference. There's no difference.
So it's basic, horn's basically like hair, modified
right.
hair.
It is. And then, And that's the problem with rhinos. They're being poached or murdered or killed for their horns. Because there is ancient belief in Asian medicine, really Chinese herbal medicine, that rhino horns medicinal. They think it treats fevers or rheumatism, you know, which is joint pain, gout, or some other disorders. So
kind of like a catch-all.
Right.
Because it really doesn't do anything, so you can just say that it does everything.
Right. And, I mean, ibuprofen does that, and better than rhino horn. So there's actually no scientific proof whatsoever that rhino horn has any therapeutic effect.
Yeah, I think that is a key take-home message today. If we don't get anything else across, that there's no scientific evidence that rhino horn helps with any ailment or any physical stimulation.
Absolutely. There's nothing. It doesn't do anything. I think probably what happens is this thing called a placebo effect, which is that has a lot of scientific evidence, numerous studies that have shown, you know, people when they have a belief that the medicine helps them, they actually do get a little bit better.
Perhaps.
You know, they think they're getting better. So there is this placebo effect that's very, very well known, very, very well documented.
Well, and Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, but I also believe that some of it's cultural, right? And social status. And I know that a lot of the Asian culture for years had been financially distressed and not doing well. And now there's a big booming middle class with their economy. And I believe that not only horn being used for medicine, but similar with the elephants, is some of these, whenever trinkets or jewelry are made out of either a rhino horn or ivory, that it's almost a social status.
Right.
Like, hey, look at me, look at the Joneses.
Right.
I've got this, do you have this type? Right. They're hard to get, they're exotic.
Right.
And so some of it too is a little bit, you know, cultural and social status, which is a hard thing to combat.
It is. And I think education too. Like, again,
education's always key. The purpose of
our podcast is to educate people. And I know, you know, we've talked to people with the elephants that one of the things that they're doing in China is a lot of celebrities are going and saying how ivory's not cool. And so now, actually, the demand for ivory is going down because people don't realize they come from elephants and that elephants are killed for the ivory. So I think if we can educate those cultures and get more of a presence,
through the younger generation,
telling
their moms and dads, don't do that.
Right. And one of the other concerns, you know, using, you know, there's a lot of things with, you know, animal products, tiger bone,
and
you know, things like, you know, these exotic animals. One of the concerns is zoonosis, which you're probably familiar with, and that's, you know, infectious diseases being spread by using these animal parts.
Right. I mean, it happens when we consume domestic products sometimes, let alone, I couldn't even imagine what's out there illegally poached animal parts.
Right. So it's like, you know, it's there's no need for it medically.
Yeah. Eat your fingernails instead.
And I'll say there's good Chinese medicine. Like, I go to acupuncture once a week. I love it. I believe in it. I don't think it's placebo effect.
No, but I feel better. There's definitely documented scientific evidence of it doing some of its claims.
Right.
So that is the difference.
Right. So there's, it's not to say that there aren't valid Eastern medicine. There's a lot of great stuff in Eastern medicine. It's just rhino horn is one that is bunk. There's no medicinal value. Eat your fingernails and you'll get the same amount of tryptophan.
I don't know about you. Yeah, I don't know about you. But I know I've consumed a fair amount of my own hair and dog hair.
Yeah, gross.
And I don't have any of those, you know, it doesn't give me any benefits.
Yeah, exactly. A little extra stuff in your food.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, you know, we're going to get more into this, but rhinos are in trouble. You know, I think a lot of people kind of realize that, but poaching in the last 6 years has gone up about 2,000%.
Sure.
So it's really, you know, gotten
horrific.
That's
a crazy high number, Chris.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really scary. It's actually really, really bad.
And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Obviously, I know your favorite's the elephant. We talked about that last week. But the rhinos are even in bigger trouble than the elephants.
Yes, yes, much more. Because they have a much smaller population, which we're going to talk about here in a second. That, you know, when you're talking the largest population of rhinos, maybe get in between 20 and 30,000 southern whites. But, you know, we're going to talk about the northern whites here in a second. There's three left.
Yeah, so you sad.
Know, yeah, they're done. And bye-bye. The Javan,
my
the Sumatran.
My children will never see them.
Yeah, they're done. or they're on their way out. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot of, it's actually really sad. I mean, again,
I mean, could you imagine if our kids couldn't have the same experiences with rhinos that we've had?
I know. And,
or even mm-hmm. one step further, our grandkids.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we have to tell them that it's our fault.
I know. It's, you know, and it's funny. It's like when I show that picture, and maybe we'll post them up on the show notes, me and you petting those rhinos at White Oak. But, you know, my son's like, I want to pet a rhino.
You know, who doesn't?
I'm like, first of all, no, you're too little. I'm not putting you anywhere near that beast. And then second, you know, yeah, I mean, when he's an adult, he may never be able to see that. The rhino history is pretty interesting, almost like the elephants, like we discussed in the last episode, in that roughly 50 million years ago is when these animals have kind of evolved. You know, you think about the fifth mass extinction,
mm-hmm.
big meteor comes, wipes out the dinosaurs. Again, and like what I spoke in episode one, that took about half a million years.
Right.
To completely wipe out.
Didn't happen overnight.
Yeah, completely wipe out the dinosaurs. And then with the rise of mammals, rhinos were one of the big species that kind of came up. And interesting, a lot of people don't know this, and I know we do, but a lot of people don't, and that is that rhinos are actually related to horses.
Right. That's one of the reasons they're my great loves.
Yeah, exactly. It's the rhinoceros, the tapir, which people may not know what a tapir is. Like,
they might not.
Yeah. It's like a pig-looking thing with a snout, and how would you describe it?
Yeah, I would describe it just like that. It's about the size of a pig. Of course, they vary a little bit here and there, and they're black and white, typically.
Right.
And yeah, they. I always think of them living in South America, but they also live in...
Malaysia.
Which is across the big ocean,
yeah,
so that's
Pacific.
Crazy.
Yeah, so it's like you had these three major species. You had horses, rhinos, and tapirs come out, and they form this group called the odd-toed ungulates. Which
my
is your favorite, right? Mm-hmm. And that means they don't have even toes. So if we think of cows, bison, buffalo,
camels,
deer, goats,
like split hoofs or
split hooves, right? Yeah. They're even toed,
mm-hmm.
and then you have the odd toed, which horses, zebras have one,
mm-hmm.
the rhinos have three, and then the tapir has actually four in the front feet and three in the back feet.
Oh, it's a goofball.
Yeah, so they're kind of the weirdo.
They took like the average.
Yeah, so. And then I think it's just awesome that the tapir, you have this tapir that's in South and Central America, and then they're in Malaysia
across
the Pacific.
Yeah, those three species don't look alike.
No. Pretty different. But rhinos, okay, so arose about 55 million years ago and kind of split off, forming their own species, and have had many different versions of rhino. So we had the woolly rhino, which a lot of people think of the Ice Age. You had this
yeah, that's my son's favorite.
Yeah, the woolly rhino is awesome. But they went extinct, right, at the end of the Ice Age about 10,000 mm-hmm. years ago. One rhino that's really cool, and I'm going to put the picture up on the show notes, and this is the giant rhino of Siberia.
I've never heard of this rhino.
This thing is amazing. Like, it is crazy looking, and so that's why I really wanted to kind of touch upon it. First of all, because we did have these huge species of rhino.
How big?
So even bigger than the ones we have today, right? So this one was almost the size of a mammoth.
What?
Yeah. So you had a mammoth that stood 9 to 11 feet at the shoulder.
That's very tall.
These ones could stand almost 7 feet at the shoulder.
Really?
Yeah, they're huge. And then they had this enormous looking, you know, horn that just sticks straight up from their nose. And it's really funky looking.
Let me see a picture of
that. Yeah, so you can see the picture of...
Oh, yeah, you have to put that online. Yeah, so that's amazing. Yeah. It looks like it has a dunce cap on or something.
Yeah, it's crazy. And
evolution.
So, yeah, and they have, you know, skeletons of these guys. So, yeah, very, very cool looking old ancient rhino species. Okay, but these guys went extinct about 30,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Today, we really have two lineages, almost like the elephants. We have the African and the Asian, and then we have many... species of rhinos. So there's five main species. Most people think of rhinos, they think of the white rhino.
The iconic one.
Right. The one that everybody's like, oh, when they think of a rhino, they think of this big, huge one.
The African.
The African whites. There is the African black rhinos, which are a little bit smaller. We'll get into the physical sizes. And then you have really three species of Asian. You have the Indian, the Sumatran, and the Javan. So the white rhino, interesting, the name, it's not because they're white, right?
I think they're gray.
Yeah, they're gray. And they're Afrikaans. If the Afrikaans called them wide, W-Y-D, but the way they said it, the Europeans heard white.
Oh, interesting.
So instead of wide, and it's because they're lips, right? So
Yeah, the broad, flat, grazing lips.
Yeah, so they said wide lip is really, but they thought, oh, white. Okay, the white rhino, and they're
so gray. Then is the black a play off the white?
Yeah, I think so. Must be. Right.
Interesting.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so the white rhino is probably the one species most people think of. And there was two subspecies. There's the southern whites, which probably doing the best of any rhino on Earth, but still not doing great.
No.
Yeah, not doing well at all. They're less than 30,000, in between 20 and 30,000 left.
Yeah, and I think we talked a lot about numbers of elephants last week. Correct me if I'm wrong, but in general, the rhino population is
much lower.
Much lower.
Yeah, I mean, you know, elephant population, you're talking 500,000, a little less than 500,000.
For African
elephants, and then 40,000 for the Asians. Rhinos, you're talking 30,000 whites, and that's the best population. You know, and then when you get to the blacks, you're looking at 3,500, 4,000.
Numbers plummet.
Right, and then it's even worse for some of them. One I really want to talk about is the northern whites, and that they've been in the news, and some people may be aware of them. There's three left of northern whites.
So sad.
Yeah, they're done. They're going extinct. Yes. They will be extinct in
my
our lifetime.
My son will not know about them.
Yeah.
Or he will, because I'll tell them about them.
Or you'll get on the project and go over to Africa.
Or I'll save them, yeah.
Which is very possible with you. Anyways, there's only three left, one male, two female. The male Sudan, he's 44 years old. So he's not got much more time on Earth. Then Najin, who's a 28-year-old female, and then Fatu is the daughter to Najin. She's 17. So you and I both are working with the researchers that are fighting to try to save these species. Both our personal conversations with them pretty much recognize the species is on their way out. These are not a breeding population.
Well, it's not sustainable with only three.
Yeah. I mean. And maybe, you know, we can bank some genetics.
Well, there have been more in captivity. Not a lot, but there are definitely a lot more, I believe, at San Diego Global. And then, of course, in some European zoos and in some conservation centers in Africa. And they have a lot, not a lot, but they have a fair amount of cryopreserved gametes and whatnot that they potentially could use to, if they wanted to help save the species,
or at least revive
them or learn more about them. So, because the northern white rhinos the three that are alive are pretty much deemed non-reproducible.
Right.
And so they would need the genetics from this frozen zoo.
Right.
And researchers are a great race against the clock to try to figure out what to do with this frozen zoo of these northern white rhinos, as far as using artificial techniques with the southern rhino,
right.
potentially breed them with southerns, or at least learn more about how to do these artificial techniques or in vitro and in vivo techniques to save these guys or to help save the white rhinos, I should say. We learn about the northerns to help save the white. And then,
yeah, the whites or the blacks.
Or the Asians.
Or the Asians, right.
So, yeah, it's pretty an incredible project, and it's a lot of the reproductive technologies, of course, are there in humans and in cows, and even to a certain extent in horses, but nothing like this has been attempted in rhinos, so we have a lot to learn about the reproductive physiology and if this would even work as far as artificial insemination or embryo transfer.
Some of these advanced techniques.
Some really cool things.
And I think the northern whites is a great microcosm of this sixth mass extinction that we find ourselves in.
We are witnessing.
Right, that we're in. We're in the middle of it, right? So they, you know, if you look at this species specifically, and we look at populations in 1900, there was about maybe 3,000 left of northern whites. And then the last 100 years, in the 70s, there was about 500 left. And then in 2003, there was 30 left. And then here in the year, you know, we're closing up 2017.
In modern times, we went from 3,000 to 3.
Yeah.
In over 100 years with technology, and we just let that happen.
Right. And it's happening to many species, not just the northern whites. So that's kind of a a really
wake up call
highlight, right, of what it is. So the southern whites are the ones that are doing okay, but still not that great. Then you have the black rhino. So the other African rhino is the black rhino. There's maybe 3,000 left. Three subspecies. We know the western black rhino just went extinct 5 years ago. There's the Chobe black rhino, the Ugandan black rhino. They think they're extinct. So the other two subspecies is the eastern blacks, which are the ones that are doing okay. Not great.
I think you use that term loosely.
Yeah, they're doing horrible. They're in Tanzania, so there's a few small populations there. And then the south central black rhino are the ones that are kind of trying to be reintroduced to parts of Africa. Now, the Asians, the three Asians, there's the Indian rhino, which...
Or the also known as the greater one-horn.
Right, the greater one-horn rhino. And this is the one that is really funky looking.
Yeah, this is one of the ones, the first time I saw it in person in a conservation center here in Florida, I was moved because right. It was such a unique and different looking right. rhino as far as its body. It has almost like plates.
Right.
They're not plates, obviously. Yeah. The way its skin folds over in different parts is just super unique.
And right. It almost looks like a dinosaur skin, but
does.
It's not.
It does. It's so scaly. Cool.
Yeah, they're really cool. So those populations are in India. They're of all the Asians, they're the ones doing the best. Then the Javan rhino is the most endangered animal or mammal on Earth, right?
Yes. Yeah. So sad.
Yeah, there's only about 50, 60 left.
And I mean, it's not sustainable.
Yeah, they're in one park in Java, and I've read up on a little bit of these guys. They're not doing very well. So they're probably going to be extinct in our lifetime, with all the pressures that are going on there. And then the Sumatran. The smallest rhino, they only stand about 4 feet at the shoulder.
They have lots of hair.
Lots of hair.
Yes.
Really cool.
I was blessed enough to get to meet a Sumatran rhino that had been born in captivity, I think in Cincinnati. Yeah. And historically, not very many of them have been in captivity because their populations are so low. But there was a great movement to breed a few in captivity and then re-release them. And so I was at a conservation center here in Florida. I was able to meet Harry, the Sumatran rhino, and who was bred, I believe, in Cincinnati. And he was just such a sweet, cute guy. I mean, it's very small.
Right.
And they have this long hair, which they think helps protect them from moisture. And they don't do well with a lot of sun. They think it might prevent them from sunburn. They live in forested-type areas. And so they love shade. And this hair might have something to do with that, evolutionary speaking. But they're just the cutest thing you've ever seen. And Harry was a doll. And then recently, Harry was translocated to a national park in Sumatra, I believe, to hopefully be introduced to some of the last remaining populations with attempts to breed.
Right.
And this is another really great story of animals in a captive setting being bred and then released in the wild to hopefully do their thing. And now their numbers are low. It's definitely super risky.
Yeah.
But you can kind of follow him a little bit on social media or some of the websites. Yeah. And I like to always, I'm rooting for you, Harry. Get out there and do your business, boy.
Yeah. I think I was with you when we met Harry. And then, he was the one male they had. Mm-hmm. And then they relocated him.
Yeah. And he needed a girlfriend. And basically the only girlfriend was across the sea.
Yeah. On the other side of Earth, where I'm going soon.
Yes.
Yeah. When I go to New Zealand. So historical ranges. Again, very similar to elephants that I think they ranged most of Africa. There was regions where
big
they
territories.
Didn't. Right. Yeah. And not, it's interesting because they weren't so much in the deep, deep rainforest, like say the forest elephants are. But, you did have desert roaming, like the northern whites were a lot of part of those desert regions. Now really isolated in Africa to very, very small pockets, national parks. Right.
Yeah.
It even brings me to what you brought up in the elephants that, when the Europeans came in and exploited Africa, and then also today, we put up fence lines and say, okay, this is it. This is where your territory is.
Right. Regardless of season, historical migration patterns, or breeding needs.
It's like, nope, this is it. And then the animals break down the fences and get out, and we're like, why?
Right.
Because that's not their natural range. Big, big problem down there. So very similar in Asia too, where they roamed most of Asia. And again, as that population booms, you know, we're approaching 8 billion, you know, 10 billion by the end of this century.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. And so you have these effects. And then you toss in the rhino trade, the rhino horn trade. And so now you just have so many pressures on the species that it's just not sustainable.
Wiping them out.
Right, right. So one thing that maybe it's a good point to bring up here is how do we save them? And this is kind of a tricky one, Angie.
It is. It's very complex. And there's a lot of players in the game, cooks in the kitchen, however you want to say it. Yeah. People with different opinions.
Them. Right.
Because we don't know the answer.
Right.
But the good, hopeful news is for as many bad guys out there that are poaching them, I think there's a lot more people that want to save them.
Right.
It's just figuring out and how the heck do we do that.
Right. And I think, you know, part of what's helped reduce the ivory trade is knowledge and education.
Absolutely.
Now with rhino horn, same thing. Like in Vietnam, it's a big place for rhino horn to go.
Sure. Interestingly enough, Vietnam is one of the big consumers of rhino horn, where a lot of people always think it's China.
Right.
But actually Vietnam.
Right, right. And it's just, again, no medicinal value whatsoever. So this gentleman in South Africa, I'm going to bring him up real quick, John Hume, and his idea is to ranch and raise rhinos. Now, when I first heard about him, I was like, this is the most evil man on earth because he's raising rhinos and having them killed for their horns. And it's actually not. So I, you know, sorry, John, you know, if you ever hear this, you know, I think you have an interesting idea and I'd really like to debate you more about it because it may be one way to save them.
And it's like domestication almost.
Right. So what he has is he has about 1,500 rhinos on a ranch in South Africa. And he anesthetizes them every about 20 months or every 2 years. And he shaves the rhino horn. Doesn't kill them. Because again, this is like fingernails.
Right, and it'll grow back.
It grows back.
But it takes a long time. It
takes a long time to grow back. It grows very slowly. And he shaves it. And he's been saving these for years. And he has like millions of dollars of rhino horn saved up. Just recently, South Africa opened up the allowing him to sell.
Sure, in 2017.
Right. Just a couple months ago. Didn't sell that great, but he sold some, right? His idea is if he floods the market with reasonable, gets more people to ranch and raise rhinos, that he'll be able to save the species. So I go back and forth.
Or does he just want to make a buck?
Exactly. I go back and forth on it.
Sure.
Smart businessman in one instance where he has a resource that's worth tons of money, but on the second hand, exploitation of an animal, but in hopes of saving them from being poached into, you know, extinction forever.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a lot of different movements and different ways to try to help these animals, and that's just, you know, one technique. And looking back in history, I think we've been fascinated by rhinos mm-hmm. since the dawn of time. There's actually cave paintings of rhinos in France that date back 30,000 years.
Right.
So we've loved these guys, we've been fascinated with them for a long time, and if you just look back historically on a lot of myths and stories have been written in them in the Asian culture, which just children love them, adults love them. And I do. I think there's this kind of great dichotomy between, or I shouldn't say great, but interesting dichotomy right. between people that love rhinos and then, of course, this poaching culture.
Just, yeah.
Now, fast forward to the present day, and Chris just brought up, you know, an interesting attempt to save these guys through domestication and or flooding the market with a horn. There's lots of other techniques and ideas that have been implemented to reduce this conflict of poaching.
Right, right.
And, you know, one of them has actually suggested to remove horn from wild rhinos. Mm-hmm. And that seems like that's pretty genius, right? Right? I mean, it grows back slowly, but the problem with that concept is if you're familiar with the poaching, rhinos are actually not that difficult to poach once you find them. Mm-hmm. You can often, they're at the watering hole. They're probably not going to charge you unless get spooked. But you still have to track them. And the poachers can track them for up to 2 to 3 days following footprints, dun marks, horn scratches and whatnot. And so then let's say they track them for 3 days. They're also starving, right? These poachers are trying to get money desperately for probably to feed their family or whatnot. And they track them for 3 days and they get to a rhino and voila, its horn has been shaved off by conservationists. They end up poaching them anyways because they're like, I don't want to have to track this guy again next month when I come out.
Right.
So that hasn't been super successful.
Right, that hasn't worked well.
And then another really unique one that turned my head and kind of made me, the spiteful side of myself, right, right. I should say, came out. I was like, good idea, guys.
Yeah.
But another one was to actually catch up these wild rhinos and sedate them, of course, and then infuse their horn with a mixture of pink dye and a pesticide that was toxic, right. This toxic to humans.
Right.
Not lethal. So if you ingest it, you're going to be sick. Sicker than a dog. Sick,
yeah.
But you're not going to die. But this this poison is also completely non-toxic to the rhinos. So it doesn't do anything to them, and they just live their life with this.
But if they get poached.
If they get poached, they want to send this message to the people consuming horn medicinally that you might be getting some poison.
Right, you might get poisoned.
But the naysayers of this movement counter with the fact poachers don't care what their product they're selling. They're not going to kill them.
Yeah.
They're still going to kill them. And so that in order for this technique to work, people would really need to be educated over in Asia as to not wanting to get it or whatnot.
Right. An animal died for this thing that, you know, you could cure better with ibuprofen.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And one of the things that I've heard that's promising too is synthetic rhino horn.
Yes,
trying
that's
to flood
actually
the market. Mm-hmm, yeah.
That's probably my current favorite, if there is such a thing, as far as strategies to reduce conflict. Researchers have come up with, as you mentioned in the opening of this segment, I mean, just putting together some amino acids.
Right.
And basically make it the same structure and pretty much unidentifiable from real horn versus the synthetic horn.
Right.
And perhaps if you super saturate the market, it'll either be cheap or not. People won't desire it because it might, quote unquote, be a fake.
Right. Right.
So there's definitely tactics. And then probably the one I personally struggle with the most, even more so than domestic farming, is the legal poaching.
Right.
So certain countries have come up with strategies to every year open up, even though these numbers are super low,
right?
Like Chris mentioned. And this is in Africa too, so I'm not sure if they do this in Asia. But in Africa, Namibia, for example, the government opens up, I think, something like, you know, five.
You can shoot five trophy rhinos.
Yeah,
trophy hunts.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, they charge a lot of money for this. It is not cheap. And then the goal is to then put that money back into conservation.
Right.
So it's a different strategy. And of course, I am definitely pro hunting here in North America when it's legal and it's in season and there's overpopulation. And of course, the hunter uses the food for meat
and
their
products.
Yeah,
and they eat it. And versus trophy hunting. And
versus trophy hunting.
There's a new movie out. It's called Trophy. And I haven't seen it yet. And I'm dying to see it. It talks about this very issue, you know, the problems with it. And it's, you know, people going out and shooting elephants and paying a premium, but then that money's turned around and used to preserve the other elephants. So yeah, it's a tricky,
It's a complex issue that you and I are not going to solve, but in the same instance, we can educate ourselves, and it's hopeful to know that people are trying.
Right.
But we need to try harder.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people out there that are. So the life cycle of the African and the Asian, they're pretty similar across both species. They live in the wild about 35 to 40 years. You know, so hard life. I mean, I think any animal in the wild has a hard life.
Well, in captivity, they're going to live a little bit longer, right?
50, 60? Yeah, they live quite a little bit longer, not having to deal with being preyed upon, things like that. The largest, obviously, is the white rhino. The Indian rhino is about the size of the white rhino, maybe a little bit smaller. Obviously, the black rhino is smaller than the white rhino. But just some statistics on the white rhinos. The males are the big boys. They can stand almost 6 feet at the shoulder.
That's tall.
Pretty big, yeah. And that's 1.8 meters. So I'm learning.
You're getting
I'm learning
good.
My metric. And then the males weigh about 5,000 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah, they're about, half the size of a male elephant.
Wow.
Or 2,300 kilograms.
Mm.
Learning that. And the female is just a little bit shorter, 5 feet or 1.7 meters, and then weigh about 4,000 pounds. So a little bit smaller than the boys. Not huge, but not a big disparity, I guess. in size. The Javan rhino is a little bit smaller than the Indian and not as small as the Sumatran. The Sumatrans are the tiny ones. That's the one, yeah.
That's Harry.
Yeah, Harry stands about 4 feet at the shoulder, so yeah, I can just almost jump on his back. Yeah.
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 You can jump on his back.
Yeah, yeah. He's pretty big. The big difference between the species, I guess, is in the lip, right? We talked a little bit about that. The white has the wide lip.
Flat square.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's because they're grazers.
Okay.
So they eat grass. That's the plains of Africa. They've evolved to...
Like horses.
Right. Their main dietary source is grass. Whereas the blacks are more of a browser. So the shrubs, maybe some tree branches, things like that.
And with the blacks, they have the prehensile lip.
Right, right. For grabbing. They have that little lip.
It goes out, the top lip goes out like a triangle.
Right,
In fact, my one of my black rhino stories is I got to, behind the scenes, feed them some treats, like sweet potato and apples and stuff you would like. They also think are treats.
Yeah.
And this prehensile lip wraps around the food item. Not wraps, but reaches for it and grabs it. And you also... Your hand kind of goes in there, in their mouth a little bit, which for most people that'd be horrible. But for me, I was instantly in love.
Yeah.
I didn't wash my hand for a week.
Yeah, gross.
just kidding. But no, very unique, very distinct, and completely different than I grew up feeding horses, right?
That
had these flat lips that kind of, you know, you always had do the flat hand. Black rhinos are totally different.
Right, right. Very unique with that little...
In fact, if you're a rhino dork like myself, you should put that on your bucket list.
Go feed a black rhino. Yeah.
Yes. Not in the wild.
Yeah, not in the wild. Don't approach them in the wild.
And not some crazy roadside zoo.
Right. The Indian rhinos, their lips are kind of a mix in between the Asian rhinos. So that's some of the things that are different with them. We talked about the Indian having those plates. You know, the blacks are gray. The whites are gray. They're all gray. And then the Sumatran, we talked about the hair. But also what's interesting about the Sumatran, and I'll make sure to put all the species up on the show notes as far as what they look like. They have that sclera of the white of the eye you can see. They're really unique, yeah.
Almost like an Appaloosa horse.
Yeah, they're really bizarre. Huh. I mean, the whites the Sumatrans are really cool. So nutrition-wise, talking about, you know, we talked about the differences in the lips, and really that goes straight into what they eat. And that's, like we said, the whites eat lots of grass, you know, probably like 120 pounds a day, so one of you a day now.
Wow.
I know we said this last week.
You are very flattering. I recently had a child, so yeah, 120 pounds.
They eat an Angie a day. How about that?
Yeah,
yeah, 120 pounds, or and that's probably a male, so about 100 pounds a day. But
that's still a lot of food.
It's a lot of food.
That's a couple bales of hay.
Yeah, they put away a lot. Now the black rhinos and the Sumatrans, Indians, and Javans, they're more browser types. Indians, I think, are a little bit more grazers too, but definitely Sumatrans and Javans because they grew up in forest regions, right? And then the blacks, they eat more twigs and
so by
leaves.
Browsing, Chris means they're instead of their head being on the ground grazing grass, they're going to be head up looking for leaves and twigs and different things they can use that lip to grab.
Right. So they definitely are, their diets definitely change a little bit different. Now, digestion system, very similar like we talked about with the elephants, obviously very similar to horses, smaller stomachs. These hindgut fermenters, so all that grass and stuff in the hindgut.
So they need to eat like all day long.
Right. So yeah, they're meant to graze and eat all day rather than eating large meals. Now, what's interesting about rhinos, and specifically white rhinos, is they can eat and withstand poisonous plants or toxic plants.
Interesting.
So they can go and graze and eat some of these toxic plants. So they have this ecological niche in Africa that they kind of take care of those plants. And I was thinking, like, especially we talk about things affecting the environment that we don't really think about. You take these animals out of the environment, there's a natural source, you know, taking or keeping back the population of poisonous plants. What happens when you remove them and now all of a sudden these poisonous plants don't have somebody eating them and they spread all over the place in Africa and now you have other species grazing on them, possibly ingesting it and dying?
Sure. I mean, there's such a megafauna. Definitely believe they're a keystone species.
Right.
So besides what they graze on, their dung helps dung beetles.
Right.
I mean, without these guys, there's a lot of environmental
impact.
Yeah, that we don't even know about.
Right, right. And I think, you know, it would be really interesting, especially when we do an episode on wolves, how when they reintroduce wolves into Yellowstone.
Sure.
One of the things they had problems with was the natural fauna or flora or whatever you call it, the plants mm-hmm. around the rivers and streams being heavily grazed, so it changed kind of the landscape. Well, when they reintroduced wolves, they preyed on the elk, and so reduced the population of elk, which in turn allowed some of those natural plants to come back,
right? They
changing the landscape, right?
They noticed literally changes in the shift of the rivers.
Right. Because of the wolves.
Because of the wolves.
So when you talk about, yeah, I know. You talk about all these things that we don't think about or see, that all these creatures have an impact. So and then most of the, you know, this will probably roll perfectly into talking a little bit about behavior. During the day, they want to spend most of their time in just wallow in mud. They just want to lay and have a mud bath and relax. They don't want to be out grazing in the heat. Then in the evenings and when it's cooler, that's when they spend a lot of their times eating for them. Now, talking about nutrition, I'm going to brag about Angie real quick and your research.
I mean, I think it should be a little more than real quick.
Yeah, okay.
I'm just kidding.
So for the next hour and a half, we're going to talk about Angie's research. Now, so Angie's research project, and really when you brought this up to me as an idea,
that's back when I used to call you Dr. Mortensen.
Yeah, yeah. But see, now you're Dr. Atkins, so you're on the same level as me. The white rhino. So you told me the story, and I get really excited about you when I brag to my students when I'm teaching a class. And that is, you know, we have white rhinos in the wild breeding fine. You know, when they're left alone, they breed fine. They have babies, have calves, what have you. Bring them in captivity. Males seem to be okay. The female wild caught females that we bring into captivity, they breed fine. You know, we get them pregnant and they have babies, calves. It's their daughters born in captivity that have the problem. So a female white rhino that's born in captivity, she doesn't reproduce. Or if she does, she aborts. Or she never cycles.
Yeah, they're pretty much, a lot of them are acyclical, which means right. They don't even have their estrous cycle.
Right, they're messed up.
Mm-hmm.
Reproductively, they are mess. And we initially thought maybe it was stress.
Sure, I think common sense would say, well, they're in captivity, they're in a stressful setting because they're not in the wild. And so researchers using the scientific method really investigated that heavily in the beginning. Is it an issue of cortisol?
Right.
Is it an issue of confinement? Is it behavioral? And through a lot of behavior observations and through even mimicking breeding thing patterns that they were seeing in the wild, for the most part, we're able to rule out
right.
quote unquote cortisol stress and then also behavior, reproductive behavior issues.
Right. So letting them do their normal courtship and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we've kind of boiled it down to what your best guess is and what you're kind of looking at now is a soy based diet that's not a natural diet for them.
Sure.
But it's
yeah.
what we feed our animals, right?
Mm-hmm. So. And that was what people started thinking next was, okay, maybe it's something in their diet because right. in captivity, we always try to feed our animals similar to what they would eat in the wild,
right.
but it can be hard to completely mimic the exact diet with some of these different plants and what have you. So we make our best guess, and there's speculation that this best guess in rhinos is feeding them certain grain like we would feed a horse or a mm-hmm. cow that's high or at least is somewhat soy-based
right.
in protein is maybe not the best thing because soy has a lot of estrogen
right.
in it, and we call them phytoestrogens, and that maybe these phytoestrogens fed at the wrong times in the life cycle, like perhaps when a female's pregnant
mm-hmm.
or during puberty when you mm-hmm. you know your hormones are just figuring out what's going on. This might not be the best time to have a high estrogen diet.
Right.
And so I'm working with others across multiple different institutions and trying to figure out, well, how much is actually in this feed that
right.
we're feeding? Chris and I, of course, are looking at horses. I have the same question about
right.
horses, but in using them as a model, but then also in rhinos.
Right, and I think horses are a perfect model for them because they're their closest relative. Right,
right? They have similar nutrition, similar guts. And so, yeah, so it's pretty exciting
yeah.
work. I'm very, very happy about it. It's been 4 years of my life banging my head against the wall a lot. But we finally have some things up and coming, and we're learning. That's why I
right.
do what I do, to learn. And shoot, I'll tell you what, I answer one question, and I have like 45 more.
Right.
But that's part of research. And then we're also looking at not only when they consume the diet, well, how much, what are their phytoestrogens levels in their blood?
Right.
Are they high? Are they low? And that will help us learn how to perhaps make different diets.
Right.
And or, you know.
And it's hard because, I mean, when you take them, you know, if we leave them in the wild, and again, this will roll into some of the things about conservation centers and what we're trying to do. You know, we leave them in the wild, they run out of land, they are poached into extinction. Northern whites, you know, perfect example.
Good example.
But we bring them into captivity and it's not their natural setting, and we don't have the natural grasslands here, say in Florida, that they do in South Africa, per se. I mean, you know, we try to mimic some of it. So that is having an effect, and it has, you know, a far-reaching effect. And
sure, yeah. I mean, people probably don't even know this, but there's a lot of the zoos actually have zoo nutritionists that study their diets and study the animals and try to mimic the diets closest to their wild. So yeah, we're definitely doing our best, but there's always room to learn.
I know.
There's always surprises around every corner. And this phytoestrogen thing with the rhino, the white rhinos, has been an interesting way to kind of look at nutrition and reproduction.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, we just have them in, and maybe John has an idea. John Hume has a good thing about, you know, ranching these guys. But, I mean, it's not just rhinos. I mean, there's thousands of species that are going through this that they have nowhere to live. So if we don't bring them into captivity, you know, they go extinct.
Sure.
And then it's too late.
Right, so, there's no genetic bank.
Yeah, and it was, again, more of the messages that we're going to be talking about as this podcast
enough about
goes.
Me. I think we went over. Yeah. We went over our.
But it's important stuff, and it's a discussion that we need to have. Like,
sure.
We need to have this discussion. And,
well, we not only need to have discussions, there needs to be more action and more science behind science based research to help these guys out. And I mean, unfortunately, science doesn't get a lot of research money for things as important as cancer.
Yeah.
So, and then domestic animals, which Chris and I specialize in, get even less research money. And then when you move to exotic animals, there is no money.
There's no money in research in these species. And
so everyone that's doing it, like myself and many of my peers, is scraping by and doing it for love and to really try to help these guys out. So
And it drives our passion, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it drives our passion.
Gives me a reason to get up every day.
And again, just to kind of wrap that up, that idea up, is just these are discussions that we need to have in the public domain, and we need people to, you know, to be not only become educated, but to say, hey, these are my concerns with animals in captivity. These are my concerns with,
going out and capturing a wild rhino. Right,
yeah.
Let's say you don't like rhinos. That's fair. Maybe somebody's out there.
If you don't like rhinos, just turn to this.
No, no, right. But your kids might.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of my motivating factors in life when I educate and do talks and work, especially with children, is you never know who's going to be the next Jane Goodall.
Right.
You never know, and
hopefully I'm sitting next to her.
or one of my kids, right. The best thing you can do is educate and excite, and then people can go on there and work wonders. And we're not going to solve this crisis in my lifetime,
right?
Unfortunately,
yeah, it's a long fight.
We can work towards it, but I think it's training the next generation. Yeah.
It's a long
sure.
fight. It's a long fight. All right. So, what are some of the unique things to say versus a rhino versus an elephant?
Right. So, switching gears a little bit now, I get to talk about behavior, which I'm sure you're quickly all learning. That's one of my passions. And so, just briefly, there's not a ton of differences between rhinos as far as their behavior goes. Of course, there's going to be specifics here and there between species, but in general, across the board, is rhinos typically their social behavior is that they live in solitary.
Right.
They usually like to avoid each other. Some rhinos are more introverted than others. And this is across the board for rhinos, except for the white rhinos.
Mm-hmm.
So white rhinos, interestingly enough, like to live in groups or herds of up to 10 animals, which of course are all females because boys are stinky.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the boys come around, you know, knock, knock, knock when it's, you know, breeding time. But other than that, boys aren't there. And of course, this herd will be, you know, juveniles too.
Mm-hmm.
And just a fun fact for trivia someday is a group of rhinos that live together is often termed a herd, but it can also be called a crash.
Crash, yeah. Which... So instead of the bull in a vinyl shop, yeah. The bull in the china shop, it yeah. would be a crash of rhinos.
Right.
In
so
the
that's china just a fun. I mean, it makes sense, right? Yeah. So, but yeah. So the white rhinos are the only ones that typically live in a group, and then their habitats, of course, will overlap, especially in some of these smaller reserves and whatnot. And so they'll share watering holes, mm-hmm. or they'll share, of course, some feeding grounds. But it's kind of, I can picture in my head very clearly when I was learning about this behavior, but they will like scratch their feet across the grass and kick up grass and move dirt, kind of like how my dog does after it goes to the bathroom. Yeah. Yeah, like a little bit of marking. And what that does is that signals to other rhinos, hey, this is my land.
Right.
And they'll also urinate and then, of course, defecate to tell everybody, hey, this is where I live.
The stinky pee mm-hmm. is mine.
Yeah, this is where I live. So don't you guys try that at home.
Yeah, right? No. All right.
Although you will keep people out of your house. But also, interestingly enough, it could be an evolutionary thing, or right. it could be how their eyes are set, but they, across the species, have poor vision.
Yeah, right.
And researchers speculate that a lot of times when rhinos charge, which is very scary to people, if you've right. ever been on the receiving end of it, I luckily, fortunately, have not, but that a lot of times they charge, not even necessarily potentially to be aggressive, but more maybe because they were spooked and right. they don't have this great
eyesight.
So that's just their gut reaction. They're not going to run. Yeah. Right. They're not a flight animal that's going to turn around and run away. They're going to run towards what they're scared of. Yeah. And so, I mean, obviously they're dangerous animals, but there might be some reasons behind it. And when this spook does happen, or this charge, or maybe they really do want to get you, whatever it is, watch out.
Yeah.
Because these guys are big like tanks.
Right.
But, Chris, they're so agile.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen one run before, they don't look like they weigh, 4,000 pounds or right. whatever it is. So, and they can reach speeds up to, are you ready for this?
Yeah.
30 miles an hour. That's like moped speed, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's...
Or 45 kilometers.
There we go. Now that makes more sense.
Now you can visualize it, right?
No, I'm going to be so lost in New Zealand. No, I mean, 30 miles an hour for a 5,000-pound animal coming at you. Yeah, that's scary.
I mean, they're...
They're beasts. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful beasts.
And for that being said, they don't have a lot of... As adults, they don't have a lot of predators besides, of course, their human conflict that we've talked about. Right. But young rhino do often are susceptible to... Perhaps lions in Africa and then tigers.
In Asia, mm-hmm. yeah.
The other thing that people don't know about rhino, because I have two little boys and I'm always making elephant sounds and cow sounds, and I have a great horse sound.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise. Yeah. But rhinos actually have a very extended vocabulary.
Yeah.
And they make sounds such as grunts or snorts and snuffs, and they actually can even whistle.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just really cool creatures. And then they've also recently found out that, like the elephant we mentioned last week, the rhinos can communicate through these low infrasonic frequencies.
The low rumbles, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That we humans can't hear, but of course other rhinos can hear, and it can communicate like, hey, do you want to come breed with me? Or hey, this is my territory. And so we just keep learning really cool things about, I mean, there's so much, they're pretty well studied in captivity, but there's still so much more we can learn from them in both captivity, but then also in the wild as far as.
No, and I think you brought it up earlier too, is there's just no money.
Right.
Like that's what's so maddening about this. And it's, in episode one, talking about the sixth mass extinction, this should be in the news every day. And luckily, we're seeing more and more of it creep in. But there's no money. There's no money to research this stuff. And there's no money to spread the news. And it's frustrating because this is our survival as a species and as a planet. Earth's going to survive. Something, if we all die out, something's going to come around eventually.
Sure.
Millions of years later. Maybe it's time for the lizard people or whatever.
Right.
Insects dominate and they become super mega insects. I don't know. The Earth will survive after we die out. But... why are we killing ourselves?
Right. Why are we forcing our hand?
Yeah. And why are we not, doing things to protect the environment and protect the human race?
Right. Like talking to my son about dinosaurs and explaining how they went extinct with the meteoroids and whatnot. I mean, I couldn't imagine explaining to him or a grandchild of mine, this happened in our lifetime. Like,
right.
We could have prevented it. We kind of tried, but there was no money in it.
And nobody, we cared more about... you know, creating the next weapon that's going to kill more people.
Sure, or a sporting event.
Yeah, I mean, how many billions of dollars go into national defense when, you know, billions of dollars we should fund to NASA and fund to science and things like that. So anyways, it's, again, not too much to get into the politics of it, but it is frustrating from our endpoint.
Well, and it really is, of course, because I have, you know, intimate relationship with these guys and some of my behavioral notes from a zookeeper, like on the lighter sides of things, is if you know a rhino, you know when it's happy because it will curl its tail up.
Yeah, I mean.
And it runs around. If you haven't seen a rhino running around, you haven't lived. Yeah. It runs around and it jumps around making squeaky noises.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, these aren't dumb animals. No. These are animals that have complex behaviors. Emotions. They are emotional. They can be, you know, they're scared. They're happy. They grieve.
They like their tummies rubbed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what got me. The first time I rubbed a black rhino tummy, of course, through protected contact. Yeah. I was not in with a rhino. Yeah. But I was head over heels in love.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I guess we can briefly touch upon the repro, too, as far as how quickly, because this, again, goes into the conservation message. These guys have, what, like a 16 to 18-month gestation?
Yep, 16 is about average across the species. Right. And
so that's like the second longest, right? Because we had elephants at 22 months. I've looked up whales. Whales are less than a year or up to a year. Like blue whales. Like I thought a blue whale would be like forever, but it's not. It's less than a year. So, I mean, that's the second longest. That's pretty long.
That is, it's very long. And then, well, like we touched on with elephants, so they're pregnant for 16 months.
Right.
And then they give birth. Well, their intervals between birth is anywhere from 3 to 5 years because the calf stays by them for about a year. Yeah. Or the calf nurses, excuse me, nurses for a year, but stays by mom for up to 3 years. So there's, you know, even for this gentleman who wants to domesticate or farm rhinos, your turnaround is not very good. And we know that in the horse industry. Right. Turnaround's tough, even in, you know, an animal that we know a lot about.
Domestic species,
And so, and then once they're born, they don't reach sexual males don't reach sexual maturity until they're about 10 to 12 years. So, I mean, you have to feed it and take it until then, or that's what, you know, if an animal gets poached when it's 9 years old, it's just such a waste. It didn't even reproduce. Right. And females don't become sexually reproductive or hit maturity, sexual maturity until they're about 6. So once again, there's this long life cycle. And then interestingly enough, out of all species, or excuse me, on most mammals, they have one of the most dramatic, kind of interesting, tough fight courtship breeding behavior out of any mammals. They will often, when it is breeding season, so when the females are in estrus, they don't have any seasonality typically. So when they do come into their estrus cycle and the males are pursuing them, for 3 days or so, they can basically beat the living crap out of each other. And when you're in a captive or conservation setting, it always worries staff members to put these animals together, and it's hard to watch, but we've learned through scientific studies and whatnot that it is the best way to
it's a natural
courtship behavior. But in the wild, black rhinos have some of the highest death rates among mammals from fighting each other.
That's crazy.
So I mean, they're very aggressive. Yeah. definite testosterone going there. And then with the males and females, once they breed, they go their separate ways. And that kind of leads into some of the solitary behaviors.
So just on the black rhinos, I know from a captive setting, we have this skewed male-female ratio. And I don't know if you've looked at some of the research out there and how much, again, because we don't have tons of money, we can't research all this, but there's such a skew of males being born in captivity with black rhinos than females. And of course, the black or the males, we only need, you know, a few sperm cells. Yeah, one sperm cell really to make it. But you don't need, you know, this disproportionate number of males. We need more females to have babies.
And males are hard to house.
And exactly. You can't have 10 males together. They'll kill each other. So again, an area of research, hopefully maybe the next Jane Goodall sitting next to me can solve for these guys, it's, you know, there's a lot of questions out there.
Sure. There's definitely more more questions at this point than answers, but that's our job, to ask these questions and figure out how to live with them peacefully in the wild, and then and promote them and let them live in the wild, but then also, you know, in a captive setting, how to keep those numbers and keep a genetic basically safeguard genetic bank around.
I mean, when you're talking, what, 3,500, 5,000 black rhinos left in the world, and they're getting poached, and they're really contentious areas of the world. So, yeah, I mean, we got to answer some of these questions or they're gone.
Absolutely.
You know, maybe white rhinos will make it with farming. I don't know. But blacks, you know, especially because you talk about blacks are solitary, so that's not really a viable option for them either, farming a black rhino.
No, definitely not.
Because you look at the pictures of these... this ranch in South Africa, there's like 1,000 rhinos in a herd. It's pretty funny, actually. So maybe, I don't know. Hopefully, maybe that's one answer. I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, we definitely need to learn more about these guys.
Yeah, it's complex. I mean, every species, there's some complexity to it.
It's very complex.
Right, right. So we're looking at white rhinos. Now, are they bouncing back a little bit, or are they going back down?
Well, the whites are still... the numbers are about leveling out.
Okay.
So their birth rates are about equaling their poaching rates.
Okay. So they're kind of steady right now.
Steady, but maybe also historically, using modeling, because of this life cycle, this rate is not sustainable. Right. And the poaching will then eventually
get them.
Wipe out.
Yeah, wipe them out.
If the poaching rate stays. But once again, to be hopeful that people are trying a lot of different tactics.
Right.
We're becoming more educated, a more interconnected society. So, you know, I think we've got a little bit more time with those guys.
Mm-hmm.
What we don't have time with are all the rest. The black rhino are at 5,000, the Indians under 4,000, and then Javan and Sumatran are...
pretty much... on their way to extinction.
Most likely. It would take I hate to use the word miracle lightly. That's not the right word. But yeah, it doesn't, modeling does not look good.
Yeah, and I mean, even reading about the Javan, there was some populations in, it was Vietnam? I think it was Vietnam when I read, and it was about 10 years ago. They found the last one, the last Javan rhino in Southeast Asia, slaughtered for his horn. So
is super sad, because these guys, their horns are like not even big.
I know. Yeah. I mean, compared to the others, and it's just, ugh. And it's just fingernails, folks.
Yeah.
That's all it is. But yeah, they're pretty sad.
Well, and the other thing too to think about is when you get down to these critically in the low numbers in the thousands is genetic diversity. I mean, that's your jam. You love that.
Right.
You love to talk about that kind of stuff. It's a real problem. And that's why these northern white rhinos, the three that are left, I mean, scientists know that it's pretty much a lost cause, because what can you do with three? Even though they do have, once again, some frozen gametes and whatnot. So we don't want the blacks and the Indian rhinos to get to those things.
Right.
I mean, they're still at a low number, but we don't want it to get even lower, because it just makes everything harder. And then you and I are super focused on poaching, but you touched on habitat loss.
Right.
There's also disease, and then in certain areas there's a lot of natural disasters between fires and earthquakes and typhoons. So, and all that's normal and natural, but we put that on top of the human
and the tiny population.
It
doesn't take much.
No,
it doesn't take much to tip them over for extinction. And yeah, I mean, when we talk about genetic diversity, that's definitely something that in the future, you know, we should talk about, you know, and just, I like to use the Przewalski horse as an example, that we were down to 12 breeding animals in the 70s. Again, another conservation success story, where they were only in zoos, they were extinct in the wild, brought them back, and now have reintroduced them into Mongolia and China. There's about 2,000 down, you know, from 12 to 2,000.
It's a great success story.
But they're heavily inbred, and they have problems. There's a lot of behavioral issues. I've read about stallions killing foals, like just things that are not normal for equids to do. So yeah, when you genetic diversity, that is another major issue that threatens a lot of these animals. But anyways, there are people doing the good fight.
Yes.
We're doing the good fight.
Yes.
So, you know, please, you know, go to our website. please sign up for our newsletter. And if you've made it to this episode at this point, you know, I think we're comfortable enough to ask you to rate and review our podcast if you think we're worthy. We really need to spread this message.
Well, feedback is good.
Yes, please give us feedback. You can go to the website and there's definitely a place where you can go and give us some feedback.
Or tell us some species you want to learn more about.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's when we do the Patreon, we're going to be doing a lot of polls and stuff. Real quick, conservation tip, never buy horn. Just never,
ever. Tell your friends not to buy horn. Yeah, it's not cool.
It's not cool. And you even rhino horn daggers was like a big thing in the Middle East or Southwest Asia.
Not cool.
That's stupid. That's just, it's like, why? Why? You're killing off an animal for something that is
like
dumb.
Make a finger horn or yeah. Like a finger.
Fingernail yeah. Horn. Yeah. Chew your fingernails. If you're feeling sick, chew and eat your fingernails. It's the same thing as rhino horn. Okay. Or take an ibuprofen. I promise you the ibuprofen will help you more.
Yes.
So any special organizations you
have? Okay. Well, I mean, I know my goal was to have one, yeah. So I did not meet that goal and I have two, but briefly, there's a lot of good people doing a lot of great things mm-hmm. to rhinos. One of my favorite groups is the International Rhino Foundation, mm-hmm. or IRF, or you can Google rhinos.org. They've given over $20 million worldwide to rhino conservation in the past year, 10 or 20 years right. In 10 different countries. They actually use science.
Right, right.
They work on habitat conservation, anti-poaching, captive breeding, education, right? Education's key. They're a really good group, and I highly recommend you check out their website and vote with your dollar and tell those guys you mm-hmm. like what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And then another one you should check out is a dream job of mine, or if I ever ran away from life, I would run to the Rhino Orphanage
right.
in South Africa, and that's can be found at the rhinoorphanage.co.za. And their mission is to rescue, of course, baby mm-hmm. calves that have been orphaned from the poaching crisis.
Right.
So we haven't even touched on that. Think about, you know, you poach a mom and you leave behind a two-year-old rhino that's not sufficient.
Yeah.
Sure. So they do really great thing and they nurse them back to health. And sometimes baby calf rhinos are cut off too.
Mm-hmm.
And they help nurse those guys to health. And they do really good things. And so you can check them out too. They're right. One of my favorite sites to follow on Facebook and Instagram because they just have cute pictures all the time, and they're guys that are doing the real work.
Right,
they're in the throes of it. Right. They're in the trenches of it, right. And they're fighting the good fight. And I'm just I'm really proud that there's so many good people out there right. that are working to save rhinos.
Yeah, working hard. All right. Well, thank you so much for sticking with us, and we will
go Team Rhino.
Yes, Team Rhino, and that was Angie's favorite rhinos. Now that we got those out of the way, we'll definitely be bringing a diverse range of species. But we had to start with our two favorites, and let us know what your favorites are.
Please,
and then we'll try to get an episode on them. All right. Well, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Listen, learn, share, join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.